Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore in World of Warcraft. Sometimes, somewhere down the line, we'll get to other games. I'm really eager to talk about Overwatch at some point, but for right now, we're going to talk about World of Warcraft because we've had a wealth of material come out recently. Anyway, my name is Anne Stickney. I'm one of two lore-focused writers at Blizzard Watch, and I've got both of my wonderful co-hosts with me today. Let's go ahead and introduce Joe first. Joe Perez. Hey, Joe.
Hi, everybody.
How you doing?
I am doing fantastic, and I'm really excited for today. I've been waiting.
I know. You've been dying to talk about today's topic.
I really have.
We'll get to that in a second here. Secondly, we've got our second co-host, of course, the other lore-focused writer at Blizzard Watch, and that would be Matt Rossi. Hey, Rossi.
Hello. How are we doing?
Why I don't I know. What's up with the voice, man?
I don't know.
You're not going to do this for the entire show, are you?
No, I'm done. Okay. Sometimes I wish I was Frank Welker. Like, ever since he did the Arakawa guy. And the thing is that Frank Welker does a lot of voices and a lot of noises. Like, if there's animals and so forth, Frank Welker often does them. But when he does World of Warcraft stuff, it's just Frank Welker.
He's real good at distorting his voice to do strange and unusual things, and I don't know how he does it, but...
Percy!
Anyway.
There's a guy who can do an Arco. I've just been watching a lot of stuff about voice acting. I'm one of the things that I'm, like, curious as heck about in Legion is one of the things I don't have in the alpha yet is a lot of the voice acting.
Yeah, not yet.
So I want very much... I'm very interested to see, like, the voice acting and the cinematics when they come in.
Definitely. So...
If we can say one thing... One thing that that Warlords of Draenor did extremely well was voice acting and cinematics.
Yeah, absolutely.
I will agree with that.
So absolutely. I'm looking forward to what they do in the new one.
Okay, well, moving on, we're going to get to the actual topic of the show. Today we're going to talk about Illidan, the novel that just came out by William King. And because we are talking about this book, obviously, it has been released. You could go find it in stores now. It's actually a pretty good book. We are still, however, we're going to be talking, like, completely about the book. So if you're avoiding spoilers for this book, if you've got it, you haven't finished it yet, or if you haven't picked it up yet, I don't know why you wouldn't have, but if you haven't picked it up yet, you may want to avoid this show and come back after you've read the book. Or, you know, listen to the show, get yourself spoiled, and then decide to pick up the book anyway. Up to you. We're also probably going to talk just a little bit about some alpha spoilers, because... Maiev is kind of one of those characters that features in both the novel and alpha a little bit. And Illidan is one of those characters that's also heavily involved with Legion. This isn't exactly what I would call a bridge novel, per se, but there's still connections to be had. So,
sure.
And connections to be made. So if you're avoiding spoilers, this is your opportunity right now to leave. Moving on, what'd you guys think? What did you think of the book?
Honestly, it's one of those things, it's sort of like, about stuff that we've already seen, but it's a lot more in depth than it.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of reminds me of a bit of the Arthas book, in that it goes through events that we've already seen and experienced, like if we played Warcraft 3 or if we played Burning Crusade.
A little bit. But I think what I appreciated about this book is it's the back door to Burning Crusade.
What was he doing all that time?
Because we were out there on Hellfire Peninsula and, you know, questing our way through Terrakar, working in the Grand, getting Garrosh all up in our business, which was just not a good idea, but we didn't know that then. Illidan didn't really feature at all. Despite being on the box, he didn't really feature in any of that content, and you didn't really see him outside of, like, a couple of quests in which he was referenced, and then if you did the Netherwing grind, he showed up at the very tail end of that.
Shadow form, yeah.
Right, and then you went to Black Temple, and that's where he was. And it's like, well, what were you doing?
Well, not only that, it was a prime player complaint, too, at the time.
Right.
Which was like, why are we going to kill him? He hasn't really done anything to us. We just kind of been
What has he been like, doing? Why are we upset
yeah,
with
exactly.
him? What's going on? And Illidan, the book actually does a really good job of explaining exactly what he was up to. And I kind of appreciated it from that perspective. On the one hand, I kind of wish that it had been released during Burning Crusade, because I think it would have explained a lot of information, and we would have had maybe a reason for Illidan not to be present. But at the same time, I'm kind of glad that they didn't, because I don't know if people would have wanted to raid Black Temple and take him down had they read the book. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's interesting, too, because it gives you an idea of what you're... If you're playing a Demon Hunter in Legion, it gives you an idea of what the background to your mission is.
And what it means to be a Demon Hunter altogether.
Character of Vandal is very interesting for, like, a player. If you want to know what you went through to get there, you can read through Vandal's story, and you can...
Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
The Vandal story, or about how much I love this book? Because I can do both.
Talk about the Vandal story. We'll just bounce back and forth here. I know you've been like really eager to talk about this book, and we don't usually let you talk a lot on the show.
I'm going to get a drink. You have fun, man.
We'll let you go off for a little while, because it's rare that we hear Joe go off. So talk about Vandal.
Fantastic. So one of the most interesting things is we know that Demon Hunters exist, and we've known in the game like a little bit of the fact that they harness fell magic and they kind of consume demons. We got that from Illidan, but we don't really know a whole lot about what they go through, what that transformation process is, and why they go for it, right?
What
why
makes
are they
them special?
What makes them so special?
Why
and what
do they put their own eyes out?
This?
What is that, you know?
So enter Vandal, which is the vehicle for pretty much the entire explanation of the process of how one, A, chooses to become a demon hunter, and B, what happens as a result of it. And so when we first meet him in the book, he's climbing up to basically attack Illidan, or at least it's presented in a way that he's supposed to be attacking Illidan, trying to get through all these defenses and pass the demons and, you know, pass all of his warriors to the very top of the Black Temple. And he gets up there, and Illidan just turns around and says, "Yep, I knew you were coming. What do you want?" And he says, he puts his daggers down, he takes a knee, and he's like, "I want you to make me into a weapon so I can avenge my kid's death." And that was kind of a powerful moment, because there's all these flashbacks for show where he lived through the Legion invasion, and he was a hunter. He wasn't anything special. He was just a hunter-gatherer. He lived in the forest and just was kind of happy with his family, his wife and kid. And then he watched them completely destroyed and watched his kid be consumed by a fellhound, which that's a very powerful thing. Even if you're not a parent, the idea of your kid dying is horrifying. The idea of watching your kid tore apart in front of you is even worse. And so that sets the stage for sort of the traumatic experience that drives him.
Yeah, this book really doesn't pull any punches with graphic descriptions of horrific things.
Well, and that actually is... And
I kind of appreciate that, though.
I'll take a brief aside real quick before I continue on with Vandal stuff. The book was written by William King. If you guys don't know him, he is a author that usually specializes on Games Workshop stuff, which tends to be very grimdark. And what grimdark is despair, dystopian, sort of
dark,
ultra
gritty,
violent.
Yeah.
And he's written some of what are my favorite books, including the Gotrek and Felix series, as well as a bunch of short stories. If you, and this is light compared to what he normally writes.
And I think they made a good choice in choosing him to do this particular book, because this book isn't really about heroes. It's mm-hmm. not about heroism and light. It's about that darkness. It's about that grittiness. And I like how Vandal, the entirety of Vandal's arc, is pushed by this thirst for vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
Because vengeance is one of the two names of the demon hunter
yes.
specs that you could choose. And this makes it very clear why they chose that name for that spec. It's very much a driving point to what makes it... What makes a demon hunter a demon hunter? Well, and go ahead, Rossi. I'm sorry.
No, I keep having the voice lag. It's my problem. I was just thinking in terms of like the characters in the book that the book focuses on. If you think about Illidan, Vandal, and Maiev as the real big three focus characters, all of them are sort of like there's moments in each of them where even Illidan stops and says, "What am I doing?" Like there's moments where Illidan is like, "This is what I am doing is insane."
Well, not only that, but
I just want to tell myself this: what I'm doing is insane, but I have to do it. So, and there's an interesting juxtaposition between the three of them, where each of them, like, there's a scene where Vandal is kind of goes downstairs and tries to find a place to rest and sees the demon hunters,
mm-hmm.
the ones who've already gone through it.
I was going to talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So go ahead and talk about that.
Well, the interesting thing too is the three main focuses of the book are all driven by vengeance, every single one of them, and that is an overlying theme throughout this entire book. And it's kind of an important thing to note because that's also an overlying theme into the next expansion we are about to go into. Most of our characters are driven by some form of vengeance.
And the funny part is the Burning Legion is also driven by vengeance.
Yes, exactly. We are.
They want payback for what happened at Hyjal. They want payback for what happened at the War of the Ancients.
Oh yeah. And they just want revenge.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is with every single character that Vandal interacts with before actually becoming a demon hunter, you realize that they've all lost something. And I can't remember her name off the top of my head, but the one that's
carrying her baby on her chest.
Yes. Yes. The one that was carrying basically her dead baby on her chest.
Yeah. I don't remember her name either, but I know who you're talking about.
And talking to it, like she couldn't interact with anybody else around her. Like she talked to the baby to talk to anybody else around her. Like you realize how far gone these elves are. And it's blood elves and night elves. And these are all creatures that have lost something so deep to them, so meaningful that they have nothing else in their life but that thirst for vengeance.
It's really interesting, too, because these juxtaposes against Maiev, who's really for me, Maiev is the standout of this book. She's the most interesting character in the book. He does a really good job giving the fact that, you know, he portrays Maiev as somebody who is fundamentally flawed by her quest for vengeance, but she isn't wrong. Like, she's not doing this, you know, it's not like, you know, I'm putting vengeance before everything so much as it's the quest kind of just starts to consume her life.
And that's kind of a driving point for all the characters involved, too. And it's an interesting overtone as well, is that vengeance is not so much the all unconsuming thing because it's wrong. It's just that's what they have left. That's what they have. And each one of them is justified.
It's that or death. And they've chosen the other road.
Well, there's that one point in particular where Maiev is tracking Illidan to the Hellfire Citadel because she's been told by Akama that's mm-hmm. where he's going. He's taking Magtheridon there. And she has to, like, she's realizing, she's watching and she's thinking, I could just jump in on him. They won't be able to see me coming. Sure, I'll get killed, but I could take him out. I can go in there and I can take him out.
I'll die, but I can take him with me.
Yeah, and she's seriously considering doing it. And Anidra, I think her name's Anidra. I can't pronounce A-N-Y-N-D-R-A. Anidra, yeah. I would say. It comes up to her and goes, what do we do? And she's like, she's trying to control herself. She's like, go back down the hill. And they go back down the hill. And there's this moment where she realizes that the people that she's brought with her are not willing to die for this.
Yep.
That she's lost so many people. The ones she has left, they just don't have it anymore. They're not the wardens anymore. And she somehow masters herself and says what she knows they need her to say. That, you know, one of them had said, you know, we can't do this. And she says, you're right, we can't do this now. And she waits.
But we will.
And then she's like, but it will happen. And there's this part of it is her saying what she knows they need to hear, but part of it is her saying what she needs to hear, or she'll go insane. Like, if she actually says, no, we can't do it, she'll crack. She'll break wide open, and she can't do that. And she basically has this, it's a great speech where she's like, you know, remember your oaths, and, you know, if you don't want to be here, fine, you know, be a betrayer like Illidan, blah, blah. But the really interesting part about it is how good she is at manipulating people.
Oh, yeah.
And how good she's – and it's like the longer it goes on, the better she becomes because, I mean, she needs to do it. She needs to build a force.
She doesn't have a choice, yeah.
But at the same time, she becomes very adept at it.
And the one person she couldn't do that to, mm-hmm, was a doll.
Yeah.
The one person, mm-hmm, she couldn't twist was a doll.
Well, yeah.
And you know, to a lesser degree, the Draenei that are the Aldor. Mm-hmm. To a lesser degree, the Aldor. We'll go back to Maiev in a minute. Let's go back to Vandal, though, because we were talking about him. I like that character, and I liked that character for one very specific reason. He's kind of like the funnel introductory sort of stand-in for every demon hunter that, mm-hmm, anybody creates in Legion. Yes,
very much. He's very much like, when I read it, I thought, okay, this is kind of like, if you roll a demon hunter in Legion, this is what you went through.
Yeah.
Yep.
Some version of this. The destructiveness of it is what's fascinating, the self-destructiveness of it, because it's like Joe had said with the character who talked to her, the dead child she has on her chest, or the guy who laughs at everything.
Yeah.
Yes.
Who's the one I kept thinking about, because that one, actually, I have a real easy time even imagining, because I don't know about you guys, but when I'm hysterical, like really, really upset, I do laugh.
Yep.
Like when something hard, like I'll tell this, it's a horrible story, but when people who were close to me died, I became like, I couldn't stop laughing at things. And it took me like a week. Like I was at a funeral and someone was talking, giving the eulogy, and I had to bite my arm to stop laughing at everything he said. Not because it was funny, but because I was so messed up. I'd lost so much. I was in that state. So that to me was a really good moment. Like a good, not moment. It's not good, but you know what I'm saying? It rang true.
Moment.
It felt, I can believe that you'd find everything funny, because you've ultimately, life is a joke at that point. It's like, you know, I'm still here. Why am I still here? This doesn't make sense.
Okay, so Joe, do you want to jump in?
I want to backtrack a little bit, just because we're talking about this transformation process, but let's talk a little bit about what Vandal actually goes through to become a demon hunter. Not only is there this training, sort of where they're training in the arcane arts, they're training in sort of how to become a sorcerer first. Then after that, there's this graduation ceremony almost, where they get to square off, not against each other in a sparring session, but they're put into what is essentially a summoning circle. And I thought this was really interesting. Illidan summons the demon that harmed them, that caused them this grief, and gives them their chance at vengeance. So in Vandal's case, it summons the Fellhound that consumed Vandal's family. And there's this moment where the realization hits him that this is the same beast. So he manages to kill the beast. And then there's this moment where Illidan turns to him. He says, now eat its heart. Consume it. Take upon its flesh into you. And Vandal looks at him like he's crazy. But then, you know, sits there. He's like, you know what? I've gone this far. And if this gives me one step closer to my ultimate goal of defeating the Legion, so nobody else has to go through what I went through, so be it. And he consumes the heart. Now, at this moment, you think, oh, great, he's consuming the heart, he's got the power. Nope, that's just step one. Step two is now he gets to relive his family's death as this demon flesh that he has taken into him is slowly trying to take over his body. It's trying to use him as a vessel. So he gets to relive this entire graphic scene, this traumatizing scene of his family being ripped apart, and in the entire time this demon's taunting him, this voice from everywhere, yes, I did this, yes, they tasted delicious, I will do this again, and you will be my body, I will do this through you. And there's this big moment where Vandal then kills the demon again in this vision, in this world, and then the voice of Illidan pierces through and it says, consume its flesh again. So he eats the heart again, and it's this sort of repeating thing until eventually he starts seeing everything. There's this breakthrough moment where he sees everything that the Legion sees. He sees everything that the demons see. And that's the moment where he takes his own eyes. Like, it's he can't.
So he doesn't have to look at it anymore.
Yeah, he doesn't have to look at it, even though he can still see it. The destruction, the chaos, the pain that the Legion has inflicted is so much for him to bear that he tries to blind himself from it. And that was kind of an interesting moment. Now, again, you would think, oh, that's great. He's got this far. Yeah, he's blind, but it's done, right? Nope. It's a constant struggle. The demon is now a part of him in such a way that not only does it allow him to channel fell energies, but it's constantly talking to him, constantly trying to manipulate him, constantly trying to take control. And there are several moments throughout this entire story, this entire book, where this creature inside of him is trying to take control and bring him back to the Legion. Oh, the Legion will accept you with open arms. You are one of them. They will give you power. They will make great, you know, make you great. They will make amends for all the damage we've done. You know, join us, be one of us. You're already there. Just accept it, embrace it. And it's a constant struggle. And you realize not only is he going through this, every single demon hunter that has survived this graduation ceremony is going through this.
And I really like that whole process. I like that the overlying message here, I mean, he's kind of leading them into it. Illidan is. He's kind of leading them into it. They show up with a thirst for vengeance. And maybe that one thing that they really want vengeance against is just, you know, that one demon that killed my kid or whatever. But he, by going through this process, he shows them that there's always something more. There's always something more, something bigger, something darker. Mm-hmm. And I also like that whole implication that the lesson here seems to be, if you want to master your vengeance, if you want to hone it into a tool, then you need to consume it and control it before it consumes you.
Yep, it was an interesting story.
And it was almost a literal interpretation of that, because the Fellhound would have eaten the guy he not. That's... And it's still, in a way, it's still trying to devour him on a daily basis. Every hour, every minute of every day, this thing inside him is fighting to take him over.
What's interesting too about that is if you go back to the beginning of the book,
mm-hmm.
when Illidan fights, when he fights Megtheridon, but when he locks Megtheridon up,
yeah,
and gets some of his blood on him, there's a moment where he's having a conversation with himself and he says these things,
yeah,
and you realize Illidan goes through this.
Yeah,
every
it's
hour,
not
every
just
day.
The demon hunters that he's
yeah,
training.
Every
this
single
is
one
exactly
of them.
What Illidan went through day one.
He's going through it the whole time.
Yeah.
Now, and it's fascinating too, not just for the implications for like demon hunters. It's also fascinating for what you see in the visions. Because the Legion isn't just burning one universe.
It's all
burning
of them
all.
All of them.
And yeah. I think what I found interesting about that in relation to Illidan was that he didn't put his own eyes out. Illidan didn't. In the War of the Ancients, Sargeras actually, like, gifted him with the whole sight, whatever, wasn't it?
Yeah, I believe it was they might have just melted on their own.
No, it was Sargeras. He did it.
Sargeras gifted him.
Directly. When he went before them, he was with Captain Varathen.
Yeah.
The first time he turned on his brother, and they walked into, like, the chamber with Ashara and Sargeras through the portal, and Sargeras, like, took note of him. And was like, oh, you're interesting. Wow,
so,
your soul is absolutely steeped in corruption. This is fascinating. Here's some eyes. You know, he basically...
Here's some
eyeballs. It pissed off on what's-his-name, Xavius, because he basically leapfrogged Illidan above Xavius.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, who he was interested in.
So here's the fun part about that, right? Illidan, he didn't go through this whole, oh, I need to take vengeance or whatever. Oh, no, I can't look at it all. I'm going to claw my eyes. That's not what happened to him. What happened to him was... He thought he'd save the world, and then he created that second Well of Eternity because he knew without question that the Legion would be back mm-hmm. someday. And the whole reason that he knew it was because he could see it. He had the eyes.
Well,
he could see it. And
that's
then
the
they
interesting
imprisoned
thing, right?
Him. They imprisoned him, and that 10,000 years, that he was there in prison, it left him free to think and to see and to plan and to contemplate not vengeance against the Night Elves, but against the Legion itself. So it's kind of like you know, you wonder, it's like, what does a man that's locked in a cell for 10,000 years, what do they do? What do they think about? And the book really goes over in detail and kind of, you know, showcases what happened there. But yeah, I really liked how they went over the process of becoming a demon hunter. Because, I mean, you know, when you do it in game, it's like, wee, I got double jump. Wee, I get to, like, siphon souls off of things. You don't quite get it.
Mm-hmm.
But you get it in the book. You get exactly what's happening here. And it's not sunshine and flowers. Not even close.
The other thing that I found really interesting about the entire process is, in the case of the demon hunters, Illidan never once lied to them. Like,
He was
always upfront with them. And it's really kind of interesting because he's always framed as, like, the great deceiver. Not so much the great deceiver, but
the betrayer.
The betrayer, a great deceiver, like a manipulator of people, a manipulator of wills.
Guy who straight up lies right to kill Jaden's face. Yeah. You gotta give him something, man.
And he does. He's really good at it. But for the ones that he considers his people, the ones that he considers, like, crafted in his image, for lack of a better term, he's never anything but honest with them.
It's,
and I found
not
that really
the Night Elves that he considers his people anymore.
Right. He's transcended that.
Yeah. He's moved beyond that. And maybe he's creating his own people in a way. I don't know. But with the demon hunters, it turns out that Illidan has, like, this plan, a really big plan. And Rossi, do you want to talk about that?
Honestly, Illidan's plan, everything he's going through, everything he's going for, it's stuff you see in Legion, too. They talk about it in great depth. So do we want to wait for the end of the show, or do we want to talk about it now?
Well, I think we could talk about what he was up to in the book, because it's something, like I said, it's something that's highlighted and showcased in the book. So the book itself, just so people know, the book kind of leaves off after Illidan's defeat when we raid Black Temple.
Yeah, it leads right up to that.
It leads right up to that, and then it's a little bit at the end of that, but not much. So there's not, when I say that it's not really a bridge novel to Legion, that's what I mean. There's no, like, direct correlation. When it ends is way back in the past, like before we even went to Pandaria or anything like that. The only real bridge there is what happens with the demon hunters, but that all ties into Illidan's plan. So I feel like we should talk about that.
Okay, all right.
We gave all the spoiler warnings. We're good.
Yeah. Basically, Illidan is not satisfied with the idea of fighting the Legion at one place at one time.
He's not satisfied.
It won't work.
Yeah.
Yeah. He talks to Akama about it to a degree, too. And he's like, you know, Akama's like, and you mean to defeat the Legion here? And he's like, I mean to hold them here. And Akama's like, so you just want to save your precious Azeroth again? He goes, no, I want to preserve us all. But that means... The first thing is we need an army. But everything Illidan does is ultimately, like, it's wheels within wheels, steps within steps. You first see it when the Deceiver shows up. And Kil'jaeden shows up in wrath. Like, he just shows up, like, in flames and fell power and just, you know, boom in the sky. And now there's giant Kil'jaeden and he is not happy.
He's very unhappy. And when we say in wrath, we mean that he's angry, not wrath.
Yeah, not
in
the expansion. That would have been a different expansion entirely.
That would have been a weird expansion. Anyway, go ahead.
No, he shows up and he is, you know, flat out furious, and he just smashes his will into Illidan. Never, like, it's kind of funny because you don't know if you never actually find out if Kil'jaeden is actually aware of what Illidan has done and just playing along because Kil'jaeden is the deceiver. But what Illidan tries to do is he sets up barriers in his head, knowing that Kil'jaeden will go right through them, but that they give him time. He has a very sophisticated spell work in place that essentially removes his memories once Kil'jaeden is through all of his defenses. And the goal is to keep Kil'jaeden from finding out what his real plan is. His real plan is basically to destroy the Legion forever. But in order to do that, he needs to strike at them. And you can't do that on Outland. You need more power and more... For lack of a better word, you need a good staging ground.
Plus, there's that whole fact that, you know, if you aren't killing a demon in the Twisting Nether, you're not really killing a demon.
Yeah, exactly. The problem with demons is, as Anne just pointed out, that they don't die. Like, for instance, Illidan summons the Fellhound that Vandal killed already. Because, you know, he killed it with a knife. That's when he'd already killed this thing once, but that doesn't matter. It just went back to the Nether, and then he summoned it again. And then, so until Vandal had pulled out its heart and ate it, the thing hadn't been stopped. Now it's trapped inside Vandal's body. Previous to that, it was just free to come back as many times as it wanted. That's the big problem with the Legion. And that's why I say it ties to the Alpha, because there's moments in the Alpha where it's made explicitly clear that, yeah, you know those demons you've beaten before? That wasn't anything. You shouldn't even,
They aren't actually dead.
Here they all are again.
Yeah.
There's one point in the Alpha where you literally fight them all again. You see them all, like everything you've ever fought. It's like, oh, hello. So Illidan knows that's not going to work. What he wants is what Sargeras had, the means to actually defeat them permanently, because that's how Sargeras holds them. Sargeras can destroy demons permanently, and that knowledge is what you need. This is the part that I don't really – it's like a keystone or something. I haven't quite finished the entirety of the book. So I'm a little sketch on this part of it. But essentially he wants to get his hands on it, to get his hands on the world where they were imprisoned in the first place, and use that against the Legion, first on Outland and then everywhere. He says – and the thing is Illidan is perfectly comfortable with using demons against demons. That's the whole – that is the crux of Illidan in a nutshell. Illidan is a firm believer in the fight fire with fire approach to fighting problems. If Illidan has a problem, his first idea of how to deal with it is to use it against itself. That's the demon hunters in a nutshell. If you're a demon hunter, Illidan's demon hunters are all essentially, that's what they are. They're using demons to fight demons. Literally inside themselves, they have ingested a demon and they are now using it.
It's like a warlock, only on steroids, demon steroids, demon heart steroids.
Warlocks don't – it's funny because warlocks make pacts and make deals and kind of like negotiate with demons.
Yeah.
Demon hunters don't.
They straight up use them. Straight up.
It's sort of – it's in a way, it's sort of similar to the idea of the shaman versus the dark shaman.
That is kind of similar because shaman – typically a shaman, when a shaman is casting a spell or something like that, they ask the spirits to do something for them. Sure. And the spirits always have the option to say, nah, I'm out of here.
Yeah. The dark shaman
harness them and force them to do things, and that's why they were so despicable in what was that, Tides of War?
Yeah, Tides of War and Siege of Orgrimmar, because they're in siege as well.
Yeah, but I mean in the novel Tides of War, if you read the novel, the regular shaman are horrified at what they see out of the dark shaman, because the dark shaman aren't respecting the spirits, they aren't asking the spirits for their aid or anything, they're just taking them. Taking possession of them, forcing them to do things.
They're even torturing them if they say no.
Yeah, yeah. And they don't give them the option of that out. There's no respect there whatsoever. It's just enslavement.
And in a weird way, that's kind of the similarity to the demon hunter. Plus, the warlocks generally, when they get corrupted by fel energies, it's just happening because fel energy is corruptive. They don't eat demons. You know, this is very literal. This is not a metaphor. When Joe says eat the heart, he literally means that Vandal rips out the heart. Well, actually, Illidan rips
the heart. He went all Daenerys on that thing. Just like,
Straight up eats it. So that's like Illidan's whole plan essentially boils down to find this power that Sargeras had, get it, and use it against the Legion. The very thing that allowed Sargeras to make the Legion in the first place, the secret of how to kill them, that's what he wants to get his hands on. And once he has it, he believes, then he can basically, he can do to Kil'jaeden what Kil'jaeden has done to so many others. He can kill him, and it'll be for real. It'll be done.
He really wants Kil'jaeden dead.
Oh, yeah, because Kil'jaeden
really wants Kil'jaeden dead.
Yeah. Kil'jaeden made him a puppet, and Arthas manipulated him a little bit, so he hates Arthas, but Kil'jaeden made of him a puppet. He despises Kil'jaeden for that. Because that's one thing Illidan has always sought. It's funny because if you really look at Illidan's journey here, his attempts to stay out of Maiev's grip, his attempt to get revenge on the Legion, it's all rooted in that same thing. He doesn't, almost like the poem Invictus, I am the captain of my fate, I am the master of my soul. That's Illidan. He wants that more than anything. He wants to be the master of his own soul.
So everything in a way,
to get that power and do that.
In a way, Kil'jaeden is kind of Illidan's fellhound.
Yeah.
Vandal had to eat the fellhound's heart. He had to destroy the fellhound because the fellhound was the one thing that was that pinnacle moment. Illidan's moment is Kil'jaeden. And he hasn't gotten his vengeance yet.
It would be Sargeras if Sargeras was still around to do it to.
Probably, yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. For Illidan, it's like Illidan, it's the entire Burning Legion, the fact that it even exists.
Well, and the thing is like Sargeras is, he's mentioned, but he's never seen.
Mm-hmm.
He's not present. And I found that kind of curious too, because Sargeras isn't dead as far as we know, but all of the actions that have been taken against Azeroth so far have been either Kil Jaeden or Archimonde. His two right-hand men, Draenei, Eredar, whatever you want to call them.
What's the thing is, it's actually like, you have them, Archimonde is essentially the right hand of Sargeras, and Kil Jaeden is the left hand of Sargeras, which is like, considering how evil everybody else is, that puts Kil Jaeden in a special box. You know, I'm the guy who does the things that are too creepy for him. There's something too creepy for him. We're trying to find it. When we do, I'll do it just to prove that I'm worse. But yeah, right now he seems to be just as bad as me. But we're getting there.
Yeah. So, Joe, do you want to talk about, like, there's a lot that happens in this book. there's a lot that happens in this book. But what I kind of want to talk about is Illidan in his quest to annihilate the Burning Legion. Now, keep in mind, while all of this is going on, stuff is happening. And I really like the timeline of this book because it lays it out very clearly how long it took for things to happen. And mm-hmm. when we get to the point where the Alliance and Horde arrive on Outland,
mm-hmm.
it's only a few short months before we're knocking on the Black Temple's door.
Well, I found the reason for that was one of the most interesting things, right? And it's not because we were so powerful and that we couldn't be stopped by Illidan. It's we weren't the concern.
He had bigger and better things to concern himself with, and he had bigger and better things to work on. I know that we're talking about how there was like three main players of the book, because we had Vandal, and then we had Maiev, and
there's
then we had Illidan.
Yeah.
But one of the other major players that we haven't really talked about at all is Akama. And Akama's journey in this book is also kind of interesting, because it's not a vengeance path, because I don't think that Akama is really like a vengeful soul.
It's not a vengeance. He just wants to be able to go home.
He wants to be able to go home.
Well, it's pretty clear. Yeah. I mean, there's that moment in the, near the beginning of the book where they've defeated Magtheridon,
mm-hmm.
and Akama turns to Illidan and says, "So I'll go get the guys and we'll clean the temple out now, right? Because we're done, right? We beat them, so we'll redeem everything and everything will be great." And Illidan's like, "Nah, I got plans." And Akama's like, "Well, that's great. We have plans. Okay, I'll just go tell everyone, and I'm certainly not going to go betray you right now."
Yeah.
"Okay, I will be right back." And he immediately goes and betrays him, like, as fast as he can.
Well, I mean, it wasn't a question of his loyalty to Illidan, because, like, Illidan was a means to an end. That was it for him. I know.
It's actually hilariously well. It's not, when I say it's hilarious, I don't mean it's bad. It's extremely well constructed. Akama, the best part is that Illidan kind of knows Akama is doing it. Like, he doesn't know the specifics, but he knows
he expects it. Yeah.
He's aware, and
he actually likes Akama because of it.
And he's told Akama, when he told him, "No, we're not. I have plans."
Uh-huh.
He tells Akama, he says, "You don't get it yet." And you know, he says, "Later, we'll get to that later." Because I think that at some point in Illidan's head, he did mean to give the Black Temple back to Akama at some point. Just not right now.
He wasn't going to need it anymore.
No, he wasn't going to need it anymore once he had actually, like,
destroyed the entire Burning Legion.
Yeah, once he had finished with his plans, that was fine. But Akama wasn't on the same kind of level as an ally to be let into what those plans actually were. And Illidan was very careful about it. I know, Joe, you talked about how Illidan, he was always truthful with the demon hunters. They were the only ones that really had the full picture of what was going on. And even they didn't have, like, that full picture until near the end of the book.
Yeah. And that was one of those things I thought was really interesting, because he told them, I'm trying to think of how to phrase it, it wasn't so much what they needed to know, but as things became clearer to him and became closer to where they were about to go live, then he would tell them. Sort of like the portals, that the astral projection, so to speak, I guess would be the best place to really describe that, where he was starting to do anchors and send people through portals to other places. So I'll talk about that just a little bit.
I think what you should talk about is the journeys that Illidan made, because
that's what I was going to do.
Yeah, he made some journeys of his own before he sent anybody else. He went himself.
When we say that Illidan was the most powerful sorcerer on Azeroth, I'm fairly confident that you can say that with certainty. He was able to...
I don't know. I still think that Ashara has a one-up on him, but maybe. Not by much.
You know what? I think if he actually gave any care about Ashara whatsoever, we'd see a very different story playing out.
I think that there would be...
She's not his concern.
She's not his concern, but I think that when you go back to the War of the Ancients and you look at the events of the War of the Ancients, I think that Ashara was a heck of a lot more powerful.
I'm going to step in here and point out one thing.
What?
Two Night Elves were born in that generation with golden eyes.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Those two Night Elves were Illidan and Ashara.
Yeah, and there was a reason for it.
I think, quite frankly, you're talking about this is becoming a who would win Superman or Batman argument.
Yeah, I know.
That we're not going
to
get.
We just need a Lex Luthor to, like, arrange it.
Well, and that's the thing. In terms of the kind of sorcery Illidan is doing, I would be willing to say that he is Ashara's superior, because it is not magic that Ashara mastered.
Correct.
That being said, Ashara's own brand of magic was so powerful that Manoroth himself said,
"Whoa, you're one step below Archimonde and kill Jaden."
I don't know if it's anybody in the Legion as powerful as you, except for my masters.
Yeah.
But the Illidan does prove that he is a lot more powerful than anybody had any reason to believe.
He nommed on Gul'dan's skull between then and now, so I guess that's got part of it to do.
Yeah, but she's worked with old gods, whatever. It's all a rich tapestry.
I just think it's interesting because it was very deceptive of how powerful he was, because it wasn't something that really, like, you knew he was powerful, but you didn't know how powerful. And even after this book, you don't understand exactly how powerful he was, but you have a better idea.
Joe, why don't you go ahead? We got off topic there. Go ahead.
I'm actually thinking the title of the show.
I was like, wait, we had to talk about Ashara for a second. But no, go back to Illidan. Sorry.
What all ties together?
Powerful sorcerer doing things. Yeah.
So one of the he understands that you can open up gateways between different worlds. And he knows this because Gul'dan knew this. And because Gul'dan knew this, he's like, I have a roadmap. But I need to be able to go and find these points, make anchors, and then go from there. And I thought it was interesting because your first introduction to this is where he's in his deep meditation. He actually leaves his body and projects himself all the way across the universe to, gosh, why can't I remember the name of the planet now? Vampire demon place.
Yes. It was
Anathrezim's
home.
It was Anathrezima or something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
But so that's his first stop, and there's a reason for this. We'll get to that in a second. But he projects himself to this planet. Like, he goes through the Twisting Nether, through the Void, finds this planet, descends down to it in astral form. He basically is going to a planet full of sorcerers, powerful sorcerers for the Legion, where if they happen to detect him, he's done. His soul could be rended from his body. That threadbare link that he has back to his body could be gone, and he could be just dead. But he finds what he's looking for. He finds the planet. He sets an anchor. He's like, okay, I got this anchor. And he's inscribing basically a magical beacon. Well, he's not even actually physically there. Comes back to his body, starts getting the preparations. Realize that he's going to need a whole ton of souls, because souls are the most powerful thing in the entire universe. Because, of course, they are.
Because his whole aim here... His whole aim to this whole purpose, the reason why he's setting up that keystone, what he did was, when he was astrally projecting, he was going from world to world to world. He was basically jumping from network to network to network until he found the place he was looking for. And once he found that place that he was looking for, he could put down an anchor point. To go directly there and skip all of that leaping around. And once that anchor point was established, he could go back to his own world and open a portal directly to that Burning Legion world in the Twisting Nether and basically go kill the demons on their own turf, which is exactly what he wants to do.
And well, you'll note, it is what the Legion has always done.
Yeah.
So again,
he's pulling a reverse Legion here.
Illidan throughout this entire book, his entire combat strategy, his entire philosophy has always been, oh, they do that and it works, so we'll do that. From the War of Ancients on, that is Illidan in a nutshell. Illidan is like a judo sorcerer.
Well,
he wants to use their techniques against them because they work.
I think it's kind of interesting, too, because the method that he uses, he projects himself out of his body and leaps from world to world. It's almost kind of the opposite of what the demons do, because you kill a demon's physical body, then astrally it goes back to the Twisting Nether to come back again at some point. He's physical on this world, but he's projecting himself astrally to where, you know, there's just this mirror that's really elegant about the whole situation. And Joe, go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's quite all right. But the reason behind his setting the anchor is also very interesting, too, because he's trying to set up direct paths. Because the way that, like we've just talked about, the way that the Legion does things is it just goes from planet to planet to planet. And he's not trying to fight through planets of inhabited demons. He's basically saying, okay, well, I could go through 150 worlds, or I can go one way far out place, but it needs to be really, really powerful.
I can go through a million piddly worlds and lose 3/4 of my army in the process, or I can make a leap to, you know, Demon HQ.
Well, and
teleport and make everybody directly there and cut off the head.
And part of this is, and this is also an interesting sort of duality to Illidan, because the army that's going through this portal isn't his rank and file troops. It's not the Blood Elves that have pledged service to him. It's not the Naga. It's not even like his bound demons. It's his demon hunters that are going through.
It's and a strike force. It's his surprise sneak strike force.
But not only that, but every single demon hunter he loses is a horrible setback to him, because the process of creating them takes so long, and only so like a handful survive throughout the creation process, that he can't just throw their bodies away. He can't just throw their lives away, because if he loses them, he loses his most valuable weapon. And that's kind of, so he has to do this. He has to take these risks in order to make a direct path, so that yes, he knows he's going to lose like demon hunters, but he's not going to lose half of them or 3/4 of them, and can't replenish him.
Also, keep in mind, he's using the demon hunters to try and get the end game weapon, the thing that will allow him to kill demons forever. The secrets, the keystone, and the secrets of Sargeras. The Sargeras stuff it's funny, because we talked about it, how it's Kil'jaeden he hates, and it's Kil'jaeden he wants to destroy, and the only thing that can do that is Sargeras. So he will get the power of Sargeras. It's really fascinating how the demon hunters work, in that he's using them like a scalpel. It's not a hammer.
But that part is true, but I also question the fact of whether or not he needs Sargeras ultimately for it. And the reason I say that is because one of the things they really make well defined in this moment is after he comes back, this ties in with this. So after he comes back and he winds up luring in not only Akama and Maeve and their people into this.
I think we need to let me interject here, because I need to go back to that. So Akama obviously doesn't get the Black Temple right away. What's the first thing he does? He turns around and he contacts Maeve, because Maeve wants Illidan out of the picture. If Illidan is out of the picture, Akama will have the Black Temple back, which is what he's after. Like, that's all he's after. He wants the Sacred Temple back. He wants to restore it to its former glory. He wants it to become a place of the light. That's all he wants. End of story. He's not really concerned about anything else. He just wants that piece of himself back again. And it's a piece that he lost when the orcs went through and spread the red mist that turned everybody into broken. You know, it's a piece of himself that he's hoping to get back again. And so he goes straight up to Maeve and starts talking to Maeve. And Maeve's not really sure whether to trust him or not. But the longer that things go on, the more she does, to a degree. She never trusts him fully. But he's kind of her key. He's her key to get access to Illidan. And he's her key for tracking Illidan. And he doesn't lie to her. When he tells her, hey, Illidan is going to be traveling to Hellfire Peninsula, and he's got this big pit lord with him, she goes, she checks it out. The info is absolutely correct. There's Illidan. He's surrounded by an army, but he's there. Akama did not lie to her. Well, so it gets to a point where Akama realizes that he needs to, like, make things happen. And that's the point where Illidan discovers his duplicity a bit, and discovers that he's been working with Maeve, and says, okay, you need to bring her to me. And Akama does it, because what choice does he have?
Well, and that's where he lays the ambush and he lays this trap, because the story comes out and he lets Akama know, I'm basically going here to do this thing. And he does it through subterfuge. He lets the rumor mill kind of flow through, so to speak. And he's mobilizing an entire army of his fell orcs and blood elves and his sorcerers to go do this ritual in, I believe it was Shadowmoon Valley.
Yeah, but he doesn't tell Akama he doesn't give Akama the full picture. He doesn't.
No,
he doesn't. So Akama brings Maiev. And well, Maiev brings all of her wardens with her, everybody.
Well, he also brings a force of Broken and Draenei come along as well.
Yeah, he brings a lot of the Ashtongue with him. And they all come to fight because they think that, oh, he's going to be weak. He's going to be distracted because he's doing whatever this portal thing is that we don't know. But his attention's going to be elsewhere. So this is where we can actually, like, strike him. Where he's weakest.
Yeah, and keep in mind that Maiev has been waiting for, like, you know, 5 years at this point.
Yeah, she's...
And she's been surviving. They do a really good job in this book of depicting how she and her group survive and how much they go through.
Yeah.
Like, there's one part where she's in Zangarmarsh as she's riding to talk to Akama, and, like, there's mold on her armor, and they've been eating fungus, and she's longing for Darnassus.
She's raring to go at this point. And the thing is like, Maiev has not been, she hasn't been doing nothing all this time. She's been traveling. She's been traveling throughout Outland. She's been in contact with several different forces in Outland. She's been recruiting allies. She's been recruiting Draenei allies to join her and the Wardens. So she's actually amassed quite a force on her end. And she went to Shattrath. She went to Shattrath to try and get a doll to help her, and to try and get the Shatar to help her, try and get the Aldor to help her. And they all said the same thing. They said, no, we've got other things that we're focusing on right now, and they're more important. They are way more important. Because the thing is Adal and the Aldor and all of the Shatar, really, they're focused on fighting the Burning Legion. And Adal knows, because Adal is a Naru, and he's dang smart, right? He knows that Illidan just isn't the problem right now, because Illidan's trying to do the same thing that they're doing. He's trying to fight the Burning Legion. So he's not going to step in on this one Night Elf, this one lone Night Elf warden who's got this quest for vengeance to kill this guy who's actually doing the same thing that the Shatar want to happen. He's not going to jump in on that. And he tells her flat out, he's like, we've got bigger things to be paying attention to.
Yeah, there's a bigger picture than your vengeance.
And she walks out. Akama was the only one who actually, like, helped her with her quest to fight Illidan. So when Akama says, okay, this thing is going down and this is where we need to strike, she takes everybody. She takes her whole force to go fight this. And obviously, it's a trap. Illidan needs souls, as we've said before, to fuel this portal. He needs a lot of them.
Oh, yeah.
And that's how he gets them.
The best way to get them? Yeah, lure an army in and then just slaughter them outright. And that's what he did. And Akama was aware that this was a trap. He wasn't aware. What he wasn't aware of was that the souls of all of these soldiers that died, they weren't going anywhere. They were being sucked in and used to fuel this portal thing. And he was really horrified about that. And he actually spoke up and said something about it.
Well, because it wasn't just like the souls of it was indiscriminate.
It was all of the people that he brought with him, allies, everybody was being used.
All the fell orcs, everybody.
Everybody was being used to fuel this thing. And Akama was like, what are you doing? Because he didn't understand what was going on here in Illidan. Yeah. Maiev was the only one he didn't kill. The only one. Because she was the one that had him locked away for 10,000 years. And he had a beef with her that was as yet unresolved. So he wasn't going to allow her the pleasure of dying. That wasn't what he wanted to do. He wanted to lock her up and give her a taste of what he had experienced.
Which is kind of funny, because what Illidan seems to have missed.
Yeah.
Is that essentially Maiev spent 10,000 years in prison.
Yeah.
The reason she's so crazy gung-ho for vengeance against Illidan is that she did spend 10,000 years locked in darkness.
Yeah, she was just as much a prisoner as He was. She was his warden. She wasn't exactly allowed to leave.
Yeah, she could go places from time to time, but her entire life was keeping this guy locked up. You know, and it's like, she was a candidate for high priestess.
Their fates were so entangled at this point that, you know, the end of Black Temple, when you go in and you raid Black Temple and Burning Crusade, and Illidan's finally defeated, and he says, "The Huntress is nothing without the prey, you're nothing without me." That was very literal.
The reason that she's
so
tied
together. They're so tied together.
You know, if somebody hadn't spent 10,000 years locked up, you know, locked in this thing, they probably would have been like, "Ah, BS, I'm fine without you." But she really did spend all that time, you know. No relationship Maia have had was as intense because they, you know, this was the focus of her life.
Okay, so we're not out of time, but we're getting there, so I'm going to move on.
Sure.
Illidan successfully opened this portal, and he sent his demon hunters through it. They all went barging through it, and they did. It was basically, this was the first attack on the Burning Legion on their own turf, and they were absolutely victorious because the Burning Legion was not expecting it, not even a little. They knew that there was an attack coming. They knew about the anchor. They had forces at the ready, but they had no idea that Illidan had this force of demon hunters or what those demon hunters were capable of.
Mm-hmm.
And the demon hunters just carved right through them like they were butter. And Illidan got what he was after. And what he was after was basically, it was records. The world that he went to contained records, Burning Legion records. It was basically like their giant file cabinet of every place that they've ever destroyed.
Everything.
Yeah. And he went through it and he found the one thing that he was looking for. And that one thing that he was looking for was the path to Argus.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I read that, I was like, oh, no, really? Yeah, no, that makes sense, though, because that's where Kil'jaeden and Archimonde came from, was Argus.
And that's the only place you can really kill them, kill them, really.
That's where it all began. And once he had that, they left. And he promptly started another astral journey. And this astral journey was to Argus to set another anchor point in order to, you know, go to Argus directly and kill Kil'jaeden. Like, this was his master plan here, was he was going to go there, take Kil'jaeden out. And that's where we get to the really weird part of the book. And Rossi, did you get this far in the book?
No.
Okay. Joe, you got this far in the book.
There is so much weird stuff going on here.
Okay.
So go ahead. Go ahead. You first.
Illidan gets to Argus. He makes another spiritual journey where he's leapfrogging world to world, gets to Argus to where he's going to make another anchor point. And he has a very curious encounter with an entity, an unknown entity. And that entity later reveals itself. And when it reveals itself, it's an Aru. He's straight up being protected, because the thing is he's on Kil'jaeden's turf. Kil'jaeden almost detects him. Almost sees him, and something prevents Kil'jaeden from seeing him. And it's not Illidan. It's whatever this other force is. Well, later on, he discovers that force is a Naru. And that Naru shows him a really funky vision. And Joe, you want to go into that?
So we know that, remember in Warlords of Draenor, where our favorite paladin got her lovely little light crest?
Yes.
Yeah, that kind of happens to Illidan in this vision. He's standing there overseeing this army, like battling the Legion as a champion of the light.
He gets the affectionate boop of the Naru, whatever that is.
The affectionate boop of the Naru. I love that.
Boop. Now you have a sigil.
But he gets that in this vision, and it's showing him that he is... Yes, his destiny is to fight the Legion, but not in the way he thought it was.
This vision, he gets, like, imbued with the light.
Yeah.
He turns into giant demon paladin. Illidan paladin.
It's like, I don't know what's happening right now. This what?
Yeah. And he gets, you know, the boop of the Naru without really an explanation of what that is. There are a lot of people... I feel like we should dial back from the book here. There are a lot of people who are criticizing the scene and going, what happened here? So what? He's going to be a paladin now? What, are we just whitewashing everything that's ever happened? Da-da-da-da-da-da? Is he a good guy now? I don't understand. The thing is what the Naru showed him, you have to understand that a lot of what happens in Warcraft's universe is a matter of possibilities. Particularly, you know, with Warlords of Draenor, we went to a Draenor that wasn't the Draenor that we knew. It was the possibility of another Draenor. It was an alternate universe. It was a different path. What the Naru is showing Illidan isn't necessarily what's going to happen. It's a possibility. It's a possibility of what could happen. It's a possibility of hope. It's a possibility of light. And he gives him the Naru head boop and says, you do what you need to do, but know that there's something else out there that you can achieve if you go for it. And I think you can. And leaves Illidan to his own devices. So Illidan has that to chew on. But if you want to know why Illidan didn't die, why he didn't die when we killed him at the end of the Black Temple, it was the head boop. The Naru saved him. He gave him a mark.
They put him in the freezer for later. That's
they all. Put him in the freezer. He was fridged away for later, saved for later, for Gul'dan to find, apparently. But that wasn't really detailed in the book. So, yeah, go ahead, Joe. I'm sorry. I'm, like, running over you.
No, that's fine. You pretty much covered what I was going to say. But it's an interesting moment because the way that this book ends on that and sort of on that is it's ripe with possibilities, not just for the character coming back and what capacity Illidan's going to come back as, but what's going to happen to us in the future, right? Because we are these great heroes, we are these great champions. And the first thing that came out of my mind, and I'll just say this real briefly, is that the very first thing that I said was, yes, because I've been wanting to do that forever.
That seems to be the implication.
It seems to be the implication, but or at least the possibility.
It's a possibility. And what happens at the end of the book here is that the demon hunters, they get another portal and they're sent through that portal. And while all of this is going on, while Illidan is desperately trying to get things in motion so that he can get this, he keeps getting reports. Hey, the Alliance and Horde are here. Hey, the Alliance and Horde took out Vash. Hey, the Alliance and Horde took out Grohl. They took out Kael'thas. They're at the front door. Dude, what are you going to do about this? And this is all illustrated by the Blood Elf Council. It's the fight right before Illidan.
The Illidari Council, yeah.
Yeah, you get the Illidari Council. You get to see all of these characters, and you get to see how these characters interact with each other and how they interact with Illidan. And that part I really enjoyed too, because it shows that Illidan, he's detached from this. He's wholly detached from what's going on. That all those raid encounters that we did to get to Illidan at the top of the Black Temple, yeah, he could have wiped us out at any point in time. He didn't, because he was busy. He was busy trying to get all of this stuff done. And what ended up happening was Illidan kind of, like, his will was sapped, like really, really sapped. And he wasn't at anywhere close to full strength when he came to us. Because what happened was when he went to the world, when he started to do that whole anchor point thing, when he encountered the Naru saved him from death. He was going to die. And the Naru stepped in and pulled him aside and said, wait, let me reveal myself to you. This is not the end for you. But when he was restored, I mean, the Naru head boop, yeah, sure, it helped him in that whole moment of death thing, but it didn't really, you know, restore any of the powers or anything. So he was weakened beyond belief and trying to get his power back to where it needed to be. And he fueled the portal. He opened the portal for the demon hunters and he sent them through. Those demon hunters that went through that portal, that's the demon hunter starting experience.
Yeah,
that's where it kicks in, is you're a demon hunter that has just been sent through a portal at that moment. That's where the bridge happens. That's where this is actually working as a bridge novel, because that's where the bridge happens. But it's just for the demon hunters. It's not for the rest of us. For the rest of us, we saw the other half of this story. We actually were the other half of this story. And, you know, when Illidan is fighting the raid group, air quote here, they're never really called that, right? When he's fighting these forces, that's us. That's us in Burning Crusade.
I thought that was really Burning cool. Crusade.
And yeah, I thought that was really cool. It was kind of like another moment of insertion. So you've got like two destinies almost crossing, and one of them is us in Burning Crusade, and the other one is us as demon hunters in Legion. It's like that intersection is that. I think that's really clever. I really, really like that. And I liked how that worked. Obviously, Illidan is defeated. Maiev comes out to like take him down. And she has her moment of vengeance. And then she realizes, you know, his words sink in and she walks off. And
well, plus she's lost too. The thing the book makes clear is that you don't really get it in Burning Crusade, you know, what
no,
she
and,
lost.
Yeah.
But she lost followers.
Hang on. Because I'm getting to that, right? Okay. Maiev walks off and that's the last we see of her in Burning Crusade, but her story continues on, and it continues on through Wolfheart, and it continues on through Legion. So now I want to hand it to you, Rossi, because I know you wanted to talk about all that stuff, so go.
Well, it's just one of the things that the book does really well is it gives you like the idea of who she had with her after Kael'thas and Vash free Illidan. She's got like maybe 30-35 Watchers left, and that's it. That's all she's got. And so you see her basically agonize over, on the one hand, she wants to get vengeance on Illidan so bad she can taste it. But on the other hand, her quest against Illidan has cost her everybody. It's cost her, like, you know, her home. She knows she can't even really go back because now Malfurion and Tyrande are angry with her for her role in Tyrande almost dying. And she's pissed at Tyrande for killing her wardens. She lost Nysha. Then she lost a whole force of wardens that she brought with her. She lost most of them to Kael'thas and Vash. She's got these 30 or 35 or so left that are like loyal to her. And she's like, I can't. The moment where she can't go after Illidan at Hellfire Citadel almost breaks her. Like, she's like, I can't spend them. We can't win, but we're going to. There's throughout the book, you see her like trying to build an army, trying to get a force together. When she loses them, and especially since she loses them to Illidan's evil plan, it's like it's the last thing. He took everything. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? It really establishes how much she's lost, and it puts everything you see from her later into context, because she literally has lost everything, and she finally goes back home. Wolfheart, imagine the person who's gone through the events of this book goes back home to Darnassus, sees the person that started it all, because it's Tyrande's fault. Every last bit of it is Tyrande's fault.
It's Tyrande's, and it's also Malfurion's.
Yeah, because Malfurion didn't stop him.
Malfurion was the one who said, let's put Illidan in this prison for 10,000 years.
Yeah,
and Maiev stepped up and said, I will watch him. And that was the moment that 10,000-year imprisonment for both of them began.
Mm-hmm.
It was Malfurion that did it. And if you haven't read Wolfheart yet, I suggest you do. It doesn't excuse her actions in Wolfheart, but
it makes them
completely understandable, though, because you look at how much she's lost. Like you said, Rossi, you look at how much she's lost and where she was when she came in at Wolfheart, and those actions that she took, they weren't necessarily, it wasn't like she was crazy. It was just, she was at the end of the end here.
Well, plus, I mean, this book makes really clear too, that, you know, she's got an incredible fear of arcane magic.
Yeah.
Because not only did she see the sundering that blew up her world, she's now seen Outland. And what happened to Outland?
It got blown to bits.
A reckless sorcerer tore it apart. So, yeah, she's like not. This has been like hell for her. And she goes through that hell. And then they expect her to just kind of go back and, you know.
And then okay, they're like, well, oh, hey, by the way, we're letting the Shendralar in.
Yeah, and she
I know they were bad way back then, but it's okay now. And yeah, she's like, how is it ever okay?
So that's like, I don't really, there's like a lot to talk about, and I don't think we have time, quite frankly, because we're, you know, getting close to the end.
I think we need, but, like, I almost feel like we need to devote an entire show to Maiev, because
yeah, I agree. I think we do.
She's one of the most fascinating characters that they've got, and
let me just say this much for, like, yeah, in terms of Legion spoilers. When you see Maiev in Legion, you see her at several points, and when you see her, you see the range of emotions from broken to, you know, kind of like new mission type stuff. You basically get the sense that Maiev she only, like, there's a moment where she basically meets up with her brother again, and they have, like, a kind of a reunion, and he, like, forgives her as much as he can for what she's done, and she doesn't really ask for forgiveness, but there's that moment where she's, like, you realize this is it. The last thing she has left is her brother. That's it. She has lost.
It's the only thing she has in the world.
Yeah, and so the character of Maya of Shadow Song really has, in a way that nobody else has, the way Illidan hasn't, the way Maya, you know, Tyrande and Malfurion haven't, she has taken the brunt of her society changing and her world being gone. And it's because they stuck her in a hole for 10,000 years instead of just killing Illidan, like she said. And she said it, like, I can kill him right now. I can kill him. He hurt my brother. I'll kill him right now and we'll be done. But no, he had to protect his precious brother.
Yeah.
And that's how she sees it, at least. And I really do. Throughout this book, she's the character I'm most interested in. Like,
I feel like we need to talk about her, like, in depth. And I feel like that when we talk about her in depth, we need to talk about her as a whole. And we're talking War of the Ancients, the 10,000 years, Wolfheart, and then what we see in Legion so far. And maybe we'll go into that next time. I don't know if you guys are up for it.
We'll see.
You read Wolfheart, Joe?
Yep.
Okay. So we're all familiar with that book.
Oh, yeah.
I've read every Warcraft book that I think that's come out.
Okay. I was going to say, I have a bookshelf here. there's like a bookshelf dedicated to that. Anyway, let's go ahead and then wrap it up, though, because I think we are kind of going over time just a little bit. I don't care. Blizzard Watch. It's made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/blizzardwatch. And your continued support means that this podcast site and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. Illidan is available right now. It's by William King. You can get it on Amazon. But for you guys, listeners of Blizzard Watch, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial. And Illidan is one of those books. When they released it, they also released it as an audiobook. It's narrated by Graham Malcolm. And the thing is usually $28. You can get it for free with a 30-day trial if you sign up through blizzardwatch.com/audible. That's pretty much supporting the show right there. We really appreciate that, too. And I think that's going to kind of wrap us up here. Rossi, final thoughts?
It's a good book. So I'm basically at the point where Illidan has just sprung his trap, so I hadn't quite gotten to the end yet because
I'm sorry, we spoiled it for you.
No,
too.
No, that's fine. I knew the danger when I signed up for this job.
Okay, well, at any rate, you should probably finish it because it's really good.
I'm still going to read it. Like I said, they did a good job with a lot of the characters. We didn't get a chance to really talk about characters like Anidria and Sarin and so forth.
And you need to see what happens to Maiev.
Yeah.
Especially if we're going to talk about her next time.
And we didn't really even get a chance to talk about, like, you know, just how it really does a good job of recasting Outland.
It does.
Like, Outland is actually, like, horrible in this book. Like, you get a sense of it in a way that you don't when you play through. So, yeah, that's my final thought.
Okay. Joe, final thoughts?
This has quickly become one of my favorite books that they've ever produced. Not only is it a fantastic writer, not only is it a much darker tone that handles a lot more serious topics, but it's chock full of answers and questions for everything to come and everything that's past. It's, if you haven't read this book yet and you've made it through this far, even with everything we've spoiled, go buy this book.
There's still so much left.
There's so much more. There's so much depth to this book. It's insane. Read it.
Please, the book is worth it just for character interaction, quite frankly.
Oh, yeah.
I would recommend it just for Magtheridon.
Oh, he's salty. He is so salty in this book.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think that pretty much wraps us up. My final thoughts are if you're playing a demon hunter in Legion, you should absolutely pick up this book because it will give you a complete, total, innate understanding of exactly what that character you're playing has gone through to get where they are. And what it means to be a demon hunter in a way that the game kind of conveys, but I don't think it conveys it as well as the book does, really. And if you aren't playing a demon hunter, if you aren't planning on playing a demon hunter, I'd recommend this book anyway, because like I said, it's kind of like a backdoor on Burning Crusade, and it's really interesting to see everything that was going on while we were clueless and doing our own thing. You know, raiding the places that we were raiding and fighting the people that we were fighting. The other thing that I find fascinating is Adal knew about all of this. Mm-hmm. And he didn't tell us. He didn't tell us, and he didn't tell anyone else either. So it's almost kind of a hint at just how tricky the Naru really are. And I appreciate that, too, because I like the Naru. I think they're interesting. I want to know more about them.
If you ever wondered why Illidan has a Reliquary of Souls, by the way.
This tells you.
Yeah. That's why he's got it.
That's why he's got it. He needs it for the portals.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. Well, that wraps us up. Thank you guys for listening, and we will see you in 2 weeks.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.